Okay. Let's talk about let's talk about New Age. Okay, I'm just going to spend a few minutes on this. I don't think there's a lot new here. New Age, and to some extent, you know, it's a fad, and to some extent, New Age is even a fad that's, in some ways, fading out a little bit.
Good.
Good. you're allowed to say that. All right, so what is New Age? Is it palm reading? Is it channeling? Seances? Reincarnation? Occultism? Gurus? Paganism? Gnosticism? Mother God worship? Yes, Mother God is all those things. And a lot more, actually. It's a little confusing, but again, it's good to ask, what's the heart of New Age religion? The heart of New Age religion is, in essence, Hinduism. And it just... if you go to New Age websites and start, now that you know what Hinduism is, and start reading their theology, if you will, they may, you know, stir in a little bit of channeling and seances and paganism and mother goddess worship. They'll stir it in there because it seems to me, forgive me for saying this, but New Age tends to be a pretty confused religion. I'm sorry, but that's just my perspective. But in the end, it comes back down to Hinduism. So you are God, I'm God, the trees are God, we're all God. So it's westernized pantheism, but it's completely westernized. So it's incorporating things from Hinduism, but it's not incorporating Hinduism. So this is just one of many Western religious movements that were begun in the West by Westerners, primarily, which is incorporating Hindu thinking into a Western religion. And so it's a syncretistic blend. Yes?
Why is it called New Age?
I don't know, because that's what people call it. I don't get New Age. It's the religion for the New Age.
Modern.
Who knows? I mean, Christianity was given its name by outsiders, so who actually first applied the word New Age to this? I don't even know if it was New Agers who did or not. It's just been a name that got acquired. Okay? New Age is a syncretistic, that's a very fancy word, that means a blended Gnosticism, Hinduism, spiritualism, mysticism, Buddhism, and paganism. Alright, so all these things are incorporated in because every New Age guru is a leader of their own religion anyway, and so they take a little of this, a little of that. But the one thing they all seem to incorporate without exception is the Hinduism, the pantheism, the idea of reincarnation, the idea that finding God is finding yourself, it's the same thing. God is everything and I am God. Here's a quote from a New Age teacher. Once we begin to see that we're all God, then I think the whole purpose of life is to re-own the God-likeness within us. A Hindu could totally say that, but that happens to be a New Age guy. Okay. And of course, the chief guru of New Age religion is Deepak Chopra. And if you go to his website, he's... well, is he Hindu or not anymore? His ancestry is India. He's New Age. All right, and so meditation. Here's a quote from Deepak: "Holding on to anything is like holding on to your breath. You will suffocate. The only way to get anything in the physical universe is by letting go of it." Is that Buddhist or is that Hindu? Well, you know, it's both. Let it go and it will be yours forever. So the embracing of opposites, that's another Eastern kind of thing. Yes?
How does paganism fit in? Isn't that like no God? Or
no. Paganism is kind of a pre-Christian polytheism in the West. Okay, that's what I think of paganism to be, is a kind of the polytheistic religion in Europe. I mean, all right, that's almost right. Stonehenge and all that kind of stuff. But again, so your New Agers will bring in Stonehenge, just a little this, a little that, a little the other thing. All right, so that's what paganism is, at least to the extent paganism is a religion. Of course, there's no single religion that is paganism. But anyway, that's not a very good answer. It's not a very definite answer to your question, but. All right, so start with a shaker of the occult. So transcendentalism of Ralph Waldo Emerson, a little bit of theosophy from Madame Blavatsky, And Madame Blavatsky is basically a Westerner who started a religious movement in the West. Hindu, I am mysticism. Channeling is big. All right, and I shared that I was kind of into wet mysticism and kind of Hinduism. So before I was a Christian, I was into this religion here, this I am religion. Forgive me, it's kind of embarrassing to admit this. But it's all channeled. So somebody will sit there and they'll start talking, and it's their God self talking through them. And so they're channeling. So they're giving inspired teaching right then and there, you know. It sounds a little bit like the early church, you know, the apostles, in a sense, but that wasn't channeling. It's not channeling. Okay? It's not the same thing. So some sort of guru or is speaking through them as they're channeling. The problem with this is every New Age person who's channeling teaches something different from the other one, and if they contradict each other, how could they all be inspired? That's a little confusing. All right, so that's coming from the occult. And then, of course, Hinduism, pantheism, meditation, reincarnation, Atman, Brahma, all this in Hinduism. And then some Greek mystery religion stuff, you know, telling a story and these kinds of things, all kind of seem to be part of it. Mother goddess, again, there is a female god, if you will, in Hinduism, but the mother goddess religion, which is kind of the most broadly spread religion in ancient times, and so they kind of put a little bit of that in there. Combine it all together with postmodernism, you know, it's all the same. You could disagree with me and I could disagree with you. We could both be right because, well, none of us are right and we're all right and nobody in particular is right. That's postmodernism. No wonder you can have this interesting blend of pantheism. That's New Age. So to me, it's the ultimate man-made Western religion by reconstituting Eastern religion. That's New Age. Okay? It's very appealing. You get to be God.
Yep.
And enlightenment is knowing that you're God. And there's definitely no sin. Sin is an illusion. And sin, if there is sin, it's just ignorance. Now, that sounds like Scientology, doesn't it? But the goal is self-realization. Very, very... No wonder I was attracted to that kind of thing.
Wasn't that kind of became really popular in the 60s?
No. 70s, 80s, and 90s. Mm-hmm. Not the 60s. There were Hindu-like movements back in the 60s, for sure. Hare Krishna, for one. But New Age is really 80s. I understand, 80s and 90s. But again, it goes around and it comes around, you know, like Solomon said, nothing's new under the sun. All right? But it's, you know, as a movement, it's a movement of the 80s. I think actually more the late 80s than...
Situation ethics seemed like it became popular in the 60s, 70s, where, you know, whatever you think is right is right. And
yeah.
Stand by what you think.
Yeah. Postmodernism is a dominant philosophy, you know, 67, you know, earlier than the 80s, for sure. Okay? It can be a bit confusing to straight, because that's really philosophy rather than religion. Alright, so my response to New Age religion, I only have a few minutes for this. New Agers claim their religion is reasonable, but it certainly is not. It certainly is not. Their revelation through channeling is self-contradictory. Saying all religions are the same, that doesn't make sense. And they totally buy into this, all religions are the same. You know, and they'll even quote Jesus in the Bible. They don't hesitate to do that at all. Alright? Jesus wouldn't agree with them. He says, you are not God, I don't care what you say, and sin is real, and you got to deal with it, otherwise you're going to go to hell. So Jesus would not agree with New Age religion. Is it a good worldview? Well, first of all, is it true? Am I God? I don't think so. I didn't create the universe. Does it make a better person, me a better person to think I'm God? I don't know. Does it solve the problem of evil and sin to say that it's not real? So anyway, I'm not going to say much more than about this because it's really a kind of Hinduism. All right, Buddhism. But this should cover two religions today. All right, Buddhism is the principal religion of Korea, Japan, Cambodia, Vietnam, Thailand, Burma, Sri Lanka, and not the principal religion of China, but a highly influential religion in China. It's hard to count Buddhists. All right. In China, you know, they don't check a box that says I'm Buddhist. All right, so we can't count Buddhists, but people estimate 400 million, 500 million. So that's pretty significant, 10% of the world. All right, that's fairly significant. I think the number's probably higher, but you could be Buddhist and Shinto at the same time. You could be Buddhist and Confucianist at the same time. All right, Buddhism, of course, we know who founded it. All right, we can define Buddhism, you know, fairly well, actually, especially if we limit Buddhism to, say, real Buddhism to be the religion founded by Buddha, then we could really well define it. Okay? I'm going to tell the story of Siddhartha Gautama, but basically he reacted against both the worldly pagan Hinduism and the wild asceticism of Jainism and found a middle path. And I kind of like that, actually. I think Christianity does forge a middle path in that sense between rejection of the world and immersion in the world. So in that sense, you know, I kind of like Buddha's idea. I don't agree with his theology, but I find myself attracted to Buddhism even today in some ways. Yes?
Do you know what caste system he's from?
He was a ruler. He was the son of a king, the son of a local king. So Kshatriya or whatever that is. Help me out, Kate. Yeah. All right, not sure. All right. Alright, now, the theology of Buddhism is hard to establish. Is it pantheism? Is it deistic? Is it non-theistic? Is it a philosophy? Is it a psychology? It's definitely a philosophy. I'd say it is a psychology as well. Buddha himself was agnostic, although, come on, you read what he wrote, he was a pantheist. Obviously he was a pantheist. But he said the question about God is not an important question in achieving the goal, which is to end suffering. All right. So let me tell you about the story about Buddha. The religion of Buddhism is closely connected to the story of Siddhartha Gautama. By the way, his name was not Buddha. Buddha means wise one. So he was called Buddha. All right. But his name was Siddhartha Gautama. He was born into a wealthy family in North India, fairly close to Nepal. He was the son of the king. He was going to be a king. And he lived a very, very, very sheltered life. Never left the palace. You know, servants and food and wealth and all this sort of stuff. And one day with, I guess, the guy in charge of him, he went around the city. And he saw the incredible poverty and just deprivation and he was totally shocked. And he realized, contrary to what he lived, the world is totally full of suffering. So I think quite sincerely he decided he was going to devote the rest of his life to ending suffering. Which is, that's a noble thing. So he left home, and not a very good thing, which is he left his wife and children behind and never came back. All right. If you take that out of his life, everything else about Buddha's life I kind of like. All right. So he abandoned his patrimony. He abandoned his, you know, ever becoming a king, and he became a radical ascetic. So he went over here, you know, priestly Hinduism, caste system, blah blah blah. He rejected it completely, and he went completely to the opposite extreme. He became a total ascetic. This period lasted for about 4 years. He became thin to the point of almost death. You know, wearing no clothes, walking around in the woods, hardly eating anything, hardly sleeping, living the classic ascetic life. Now, I believe he was influenced by Mahavira, all right. Mahavira, who lived, he was born about 30, 40 years before Buddha. All right, Mahavira around 580 BC, I believe. I believe he was influenced by Mahavira's movement, and that was what became Jainism. Jainism is another reaction against Hinduism, and that's the flavor of Hinduism that Buddha was attracted to, and he became a complete ascetic. And then after 4 years, he realized that becoming an ascetic would not end suffering at all, because it's selfish. He said, it's almost as selfish to be an ascetic as it was to sit in my palace and live in the lap of luxury. They're both about self. So he then founded the Fourfold Path and the Eight Noble Truths, the Four Truths rather, and the Eightfold Path. and that laid down Buddhism. Okay, so he decided on this middle path between the paganized, physical, you know, very worldly, priestly Hinduism and the radical asceticism of Jaina, and he found this middle path. So he came up with this four noble truths and the Eightfold Path to Nirvana. Okay, a lot of Hinduism is found in Buddhism, but the theology is very, very different. Okay, so this is, I was in Burma. These are just a bunch of different Buddhas there. All right, this is that same temple complex. It's amazing. It's near Yangon. It's the most incredible thing you'll ever see. All right. That's in Rangoon, Yangon, which is the capital of Myanmar, Burma. It's an incredible place. All right, so these are the four noble truths of Siddhartha. Suffering is not getting what you want. Okay. The cause of suffering is desire, and desire leads to rebirth. Now, that sounds a lot like karma and samsara and reincarnation, yes? And the parallels are obvious. Okay, the interpretation and meaning of it is different in Buddhism, but the picture would seem similar to us anyway. The way to end suffering is to end desire. Okay, and the way to end desire is the Eightfold Path. Okay, so this is his aha. Okay, so suffering, and again, the purpose of Buddhism is to end suffering. Okay, and basically, he's saying desires and passions and emotions, these are the cause of suffering, so we need to end desires and passions and emotions. Okay? That's the idea. Somebody chuckled. They think it's not realistic, but you can see the sincerity and even in some ways the wisdom in this. I kind of like this religion, honestly. All right, so let's talk about the... So Buddhism encourages dispassion rather than compassion. Let's make that point right now.
What is that?
So dispassion is to be disconnected, not connected. Okay, Christianity doesn't teach disconnection from the world. It doesn't teach that, but Buddhism does. So in Buddhism, the idea is to remove yourself from all your feelings, your emotions, everything that ties you down to this world. Okay? So compassion is the Christian response to suffering, and the Buddhist response to suffering is dispassion, lack of passion, lack of compassion, because according to Buddhism, that's the problem. Passion, compassion, these emotions, they're the problem.
Why?
And why? Because that's his philosophy, that's what he thinks. Okay? Yeah. Because everybody gets all caught up in all this world because of all the emotions and all these feelings. He's saying the way to enlightenment is to pull away from those things. Okay? And Hindus would agree with this on some level, actually. They wouldn't completely disagree with this. So then here's the Eightfold Path. Right viewpoint. All right? And right viewpoint, or right thinking, right viewpoint rather, that's... The viewpoint is coming from those four noble truths of Buddhism. Okay, let me get to the right page on my notes. Okay. Oh, I didn't finish the story of rats. I forgot. That's okay. Right viewpoint, which is basically, the right viewpoint is that the world is illusory. Understand that what we're seeing is an illusion. So attachment to the world is the cause of suffering. Okay? And he has this in common with Hinduism to a very large extent, because Hinduism has the same idea. The idea that the world is an illusion. Maya, illusion. Okay? Right thought. Alright, so this is good thinking. Right speech. So the first two, right viewpoint, right thought, are about the mind. The next, speech, actions, livelihood, these are about what you do. Good speech, good action, good livelihood, good effort. And then the mindfulness and the meditation, these are the kind of the religious activities that you would do as part of this Eightfold Path. Question?
No.
Nope. Adjusting the glasses. All right, anyway, I forgot to finish the story here. I forgot to finish the... What's the next slide? All right, blah, blah, blah. Where am I going to get the thing? All right, I need to improve the order here. I'm going to go through these slides. Why not? All right, so important terms to understand in Buddhism. A lot of the terminology is going to be similar. The meaning of it is different. Even though the word is the same, the concept is very similar. The meaning is often different. Because nirvana in Hinduism is absorption back into that universal soul. All right, nirvana in Buddhism is freedom from emotion, freedom from attachment. Clearly not the same thing. All right, so nirvana then is an awakened state, a lack of suffering. Bodhi, that's Buddha. The word Buddha comes from the same word. Bodhi is awakenment and enlightenment. It's kind of embarrassing because when I went to India and I was teaching, I was introduced as a he said, John is very Bodhiman. He said, Bodhiman. That means wise, I guess. Now, this word bodhisattva, there's three main flavors of Buddhism. Bodhisattva is specific to the Mahayana version, we'll see. This is an awakened being. So, in Mahayana Buddhism, the goal of life is to become an awakened being, a bodhisattva. And bodhisattva, take me money. What's that song? What's that? 70s there? Yeah.
Are these Hindi words?
Some of these words would go across different Indian languages. Okay. I don't know whether Buddha spoke Hindi. He might have, because he's from North India. He might have. Hindi is a modern language, 400 BC, a predecessor to India. You've heard of Sanskrit, yes?
Yes.
Sanskrit is a language that doesn't exist anymore, but it's a sort of a parent language of many, one of which is Hindi. So, I don't know what language he spoke. I don't know if they had words for their languages back then, but a northern Indian language of some sort. I do believe these words tend to cross language barriers in India. I'm pretty sure. Dharma has a slightly different meaning from Hinduism. Dharma is just teaching. The teaching of Buddha. Sangha, this is that's being a nun or a monk. And Buddhism creates a lot of monks and nuns. If you go to Burma, I mean, it's there everywhere. Everywhere you look. And the greatest thing for any family in Burma is to have at least one of your children become a monk or a nun. Alright, so the Sangha is basically what it meant in the original Buddhism is the circle of followers of Buddha were his Sangha, his disciples, if you will. But then eventually it came to apply to these communities of monks and nuns. Maitreya, which is this is in Mahayana Buddhism, the idea of the second coming of Buddha. Yes, the second coming of Buddha, almost kind of the idea of the second coming of Jesus. So these are words that are used in Buddhism. No, I don't think so. Well, I mean, he believed he'd be reincarnated. Reincarnation is definitely part of Buddhism. All right. Did he think he was going to come back as like to be reincarnated to kind of be a second Buddha, kind of like the Dalai Lama idea? Of course, the Dalai Lama, that's one of the sects of Buddhism. And they definitely had this idea of the person's the day they die, somebody's born that day, becomes the next Dalai Lama. So definitely that part of Buddhism has that idea. I don't think Buddha thought of himself that way. Buddha was, if I understand him, he seemed to have been a relatively humble guy. Wasn't trying to draw that much attention to himself. All right, I don't get that impression anyway from what I know about him. Right, again, that's a form of Buddhism. I have to get to that later on. So the goal of Buddhism is nirvana, but this idea of nirvana is a different concept from Hinduism. It's a state of non-beingness. To lose one's individuality, which was an illusion in the first place. And to become completely disconnected, absorbed into the universal experience, if you will. What about theology in Buddhism? Well, Buddha. I think Buddha had a definite opinion about theology. I think he did, actually. I think he was a pantheist. But he said that he refused to answer that question because he said the important question is not the nature of God. The important question is the nature of suffering and how to end suffering. And so I guess if you achieve nirvana, then you're encountering God anyway. All right? So Buddha was officially an agnostic. Question?
Yeah, what's the difference? Because it seems like the Buddhist nirvana is kind of the same as the
It's similar, but again, Buddha does not acknowledge Brahman, does not acknowledge Atman, does not acknowledge this universal God soul thing. So what you become when you reach this state is kind of not very well defined. Okay?
Because you said God's not important, but when you reach Nirvana, you kind of reach God anyway.
You said that. Buddha wouldn't say that. You said that. I think probably that is what Buddha thought. But publicly, according to all his followers who wrote things down, he refused to answer the God question. Okay? And if that's true, then the definition of nirvana would be not so well defined as it is in Hinduism. Okay? And to you, that seems like a subtle distinction. I agree with you, but... All right? Yeah. Agnostic is an atheist says there's no God, right? A theist says there is a God and that God is personal. An agnostic says I don't know. Gnos is, you know, like Gnostic, knowledge, right? An agnostic means I don't know. All right? It was coined by Thomas Huxley, friend of Charles Darwin, who kind of invented the word agnostic. So Buddha did not say I'm an agnostic. That's a Greek word that was redefined in the 1900s. But he didn't answer the God question. He left that as an unimportant question, is what he said. That's interesting.
So that's why he was not willing to take a stand and say that there is a God. He was not a theist.
He was definitely not a theist. And to the extent, because I believe he's a pantheist. I mean, I'm just saying this because it seems from a historical perspective that almost certainly he was. And really, like you're pointing out, Danny, I mean, his idea of nirvana is clearly pantheist, really. All right. But nevertheless, if you know, you probably should let somebody speak for themselves. And as he spoke for himself, he said, I'm not going to answer the question about God. Yeah.
I remember from a class of yours years back, maybe you can remember, you guys, you said something about Buddha never intending to be worshipped in the way he
Oh, yeah, that. Certainly not.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, he wouldn't have wanted to be worshipped. How do you elaborate on that? In one of the sects of Hinduism, Theravada Hinduism, he's not really worshipped, at least not like as in bowing down and praying to Buddha. Not, I mean, probably the common people do, but officially no. But in the Mahayana Buddhism, I'd say he's definitely worshipped as like a god. But that's because they created this idea of a bodhisattva. That, as far as I know, Buddha never used that word, bodhisattva. These enlightened being idea. Okay, this can be a little confusing at first. Yeah?
So John, how would a Buddhist respond to the Christian idea that suffering is good?
They would think you're crazy, I guess. Yeah.
It seems like pretty much opposite type of religion.
In some ways it is, yeah. Exactly. Because we embrace suffering, correct? Jesus embraced suffering, we learn from it. And we don't embrace worldliness, but we allow ourselves to be immersed in the world so we can help the world. But that's not what a Buddhist would do. Right? They don't try to... Buddhist monks don't try to raise money to help alleviate poverty. They live off of other people, right? They don't work. So they expect their followers to pay their way, you know? So it's a very, very different religion from Christianity, to say the least. Oh my goodness. Very, very different.
So John, doesn't that violate that number three? Like, it doesn't make them a better person.
Right, so you're getting ahead of me, right. Now, but, you know, most committed Buddhists you find are really nice people, right? They're peaceful, they're not getting in anybody's way, they seem to be loving, right?
Yep.
Yes, that seems to be the case. But if you kind of extrapolate the the meaning of Buddhism and its influence on the culture that's not part of the inner sanctum of ascetics, yeah, it doesn't seem like such a great thing. Not to me, anyway. And again, if a majority of benevolent work done in India is done by Christian groups, that's even multiplied in Buddhist countries, even more so.
How can you be loving, though, if you don't?
Well, I'm just saying I've known Buddhists, and they seem to be pretty nice people generally, and fairly peaceful, and not getting in your face, and I don't know. I guess it depends on what you mean by loving. I'm just sharing my experience. I saw a few people kind of shaking their heads. They've known some Buddhists. They seem like really nice people. Very. Yeah.
But they're not going to help you move.
Well, maybe they will. Maybe they will. Maybe they will. And again, I think Buddha was a really nice guy who really, really cared about people. I think he really, really cared about people. He was a really good guy. All right? But when you get down to their theology and this idea of that the idea is to avoid suffering and to become disinvolved from the world, you see, that's problematic. That's problematic. And so in these countries that have these monks and nuns, what you have is a bunch of poverty and you know, backwardness in many ways. Okay? So anyway, yeah.
I think it makes sense that the way that people practice the religion is a lot different from the actual rules of religion.
Oh, yeah.
It's not inspired by God. Like, of course, like there's going to be a lot of disagreement between.
Yeah, wait till you see the Buddhist scripture. It's going to be interesting. All right, let's move on here. There are a number of sects or schools of Buddhism. I've been using these words, so it's nice to define them now. Okay, the Mahayana. I really should start with Theravada, because to me the Theravada version of Buddhism is almost certainly closer to the vision that I think Buddha had of what a religion he would want it to be. So I'm going to change. So Theravada Buddhism. This is the Buddhism in Sri Lanka. We call it Ceylon, Thailand, Burma, Cambodia, and Laos. So South Asia, Southeast Asia, Sri Lanka. Nirvana is achievable only for the very few truly committed. All right. So again, they believe in reincarnation. So for the mass of humanity, your goal is just to kind of get through this life, kind of, you know, do a few Buddhist things and kind of hopefully come back and kind of move up the ladder. But there's a very, very small, limited number of people who could achieve nirvana, who could be like the disciples of Buddha, his samsara, the ones that, I'm sorry, that's the wrong word, but the followers, the people in the community. So only the members of the community could achieve enlightenment. All right, so therefore, this version of Hinduism tends to have more monks and nuns and to be very, very ascetic. You know, living, you know, just wearing the orange robes, you've seen that, yes? That's this kind of Buddhism. All right? If you go to Burma, you see them everywhere. Thailand, a lot, quite as well. All right, this is the southern Buddhism, which, you know, from what I've studied about Buddha, this seems to fit his philosophy more than the Mahayana Buddhism. All right, so the Theravada, also known as the Hinayana, which means the smaller vehicle, that's kind of a put down. So we'll go with Theravada. This is the Hinduism in South Asia. I'm sorry, the Buddhism. And of course, this displaced Hinduism in those areas because they were Hindu before the Buddhism came in. Then there's the Mahayana, the greater vehicle. This is the form of Buddhism which Americans have been exposed to, mostly. For example, Zen Buddhism, which is the most well-known form of Buddhism, and other kinds there. This is China, Korea, Japan, Vietnam. And here they have the idea of the Bodhisattva. So our goal is to become like another Buddha, a little Buddha. Okay? And there have been many, many Buddhas, many incarnations of Buddha. And the one that was lived in North India in the 6th century BC, that's just one of many Buddhas. He was the most Buddha of all Buddhas. Okay? And it believes that nirvana is possible for all. So all people could become bodhisattva. So it's a more it's I guess more for the common people. All right, and so anybody could achieve this level of being a bodhisattva through this process of the Eightfold Path and the Four Noble Truths, that kind of thing. Okay, a third major branch of Buddhism is Vajrayana. This is the kind that you see when you see people going mountain climbing in Nepal. It's also the kind in Tibet. It's a very different kind of Buddhism. A lot of chanting, mystical powers. It's a lot about power and contacting that kind of power. That the Dalai Lama is a tantric Buddhist. It's also called tantric Buddhism or Vajrayana. It stresses ritual, initiations, mystical powers. All of them include meditation, obviously. And it's the Buddhism of Mongolia, Tibet, and Nepal. Okay, and so you have this sort of inner secret knowledge. You tap into this inner secret knowledge, and you get a great amount of power. And from my perspective, it's just my perspective, Vajrayana Buddhism doesn't seem a whole lot like what Buddha said or did or anything. It seems like, wow, it's so different. Again, that's just my perspective. Now, there are a number of other minor sects. Most of the important sects of Buddhism that would have influence here in America, I'll take your question in a second, Jan, would come from the Mahayana, Zen Buddhism, and what's his name? Lakers, Zen Master, whatever. Zen and the art of motorcycle maintenance, you know, all these Buddhist westernized versions, those come from Zen. And then the Pure Land, Naha Amida Butsu, these Pure Land Buddhists, these are the ones that are kind of doing all this meditating and that kind of stuff. Okay, Jan, what was your question?
Yeah, there's so many Asian cultures that I know of that are so ancient ancestors. Now, how is
that's Confucianism. Confucianism. Okay, now I'm supposed to be done at 10 of, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to do a very, very quick version of finishing up Buddhism here. The spread of Buddhism started here. This is where Buddha lived, the heartland, where his tens of thousands of converts lived. He lived to be 80 years old. He was the Buddha for about 45 of those years. All right, and it spread throughout India first. All right, and then this guy Ashoka in the 4th century BC, he was the most powerful of all the kings pretty much in the entire history of India, and he conquered almost the entire Indian subcontinent, and he converted to Buddhism. And so he had thousands of Buddhist monasteries built up, and he made Buddhism essentially a world religion. Okay, at that point, because up to then, really Buddhism was just another kind of Hinduism, and it took a life of its own. It went from there to Sri Lanka, Ceylon. From Sri Lanka, it's traveled to Southeast Asia, Myanmar, Thailand, and of course, it was very influential in Indonesia. It's almost completely wiped out in Indonesia, except in Bali, this little tiny island there. It was also carried into China, not through Tibet. It got to Tibet like this. Strange. All right. But it went through the spice route here into China about 100 BC to 0 BC. And it became a very dominant religion in China for a period of time. It almost subsumed Confucianism. It had been there already for 500 years. And then Confucianism kind of fought back. And then they've kind of reached an equilibrium. So Buddhism is spread throughout China and Korea. It became even more dominant in Korea and then in Japan, of course. It's the dominant religion in Japan, Korea, Vietnam, Cambodia, Thailand, Burma, and Sri Lanka. It's a very, very minor. It's virtually non-existent in India. Virtually, completely non-existent. Because it rejects the caste system. And if you reject the caste system, it's hard to maintain that in India. Okay, very good. A picture. That's that wonderful temple there in Yangon. I got lucky when I took that picture. Wow, that was a... All right, there it is again. Many monks and nuns who live ascetic lives. The lay Buddhists, which would be us if we became a Buddhist, we practice some basic stuff like not killing, not stealing, not having sex. Whoops, wait. Well, maybe we do that. Not lying and not getting drunk. The ethics of Buddhism would be similar to Christian ethics in many, many ways. Not in every way, but in many, many ways. And Buddha was very strong on ethics and ethical behavior. Seems like a good thing. Meditation is a big part of many Buddhist traditions. You set a mantra and all that kind of stuff. So there's a Buddhist monk at a monastery there, and then the regular worshippers behind him doing their thing. These are just some monks. In Myanmar, everywhere you go, you see monks. And if they're wearing purple, pink, that means they're a female monk. Of course, they don't have any hair, so it's hard to know right away. And the family sends them off at the age of 10, 11, or 12, and they say, all right, you're a monk. If you don't like it, too bad, you're a monk. But actually, it's the greatest honor is to be, because then you're part of the community. Again, this is Hinayana Buddhism, which being part of the Sangha, the community, is the way to Nirvana. Okay? Buddhist scriptures. I better stop there. I thought I might be able to finish Buddhism. Oh yeah, here we go. The Buddhist scripture would fill a whole room. It's very confusing. But we'll end there. We'll finish Eastern religion next Saturday. Yes?
You said by the end of his life he was LinkedIn because of
No, no. By the end of those 4 years, he was virtually died.
And then when he came, I mean, because all the statues that he had Buddha, he's big, fat, squishy, and you rub the belly, and like, how does that?
That represents the fact that he was happy. He was a very happy guy once he found the Eightfold Path. He officially gave up asceticism. He still lived a very ascetic life by almost any standard, but he gave up the stupid, crazy asceticism. I don't think he stayed the rest of his life skinny like, but you see many statues of him like an ascetic. Many. Yes.
Was he literate? Did he write anything down?
His writing, what he said was not written down during his lifetime for about 400 years. So even if it was literate, it wouldn't really matter because he didn't write down his teachings. It was memorized by his followers. Okay, end the tape.